I'm Andrew Schwartz, and you're listening to The Truth of the Matter, a podcast by CSIS where we break down the top policy issues of the day and talk with the people that can help us best understand what's really going on.
To get to the truth of the matter about events that are going to take place at the G7 and all the events surrounding the G7, we have with us my colleague Stephanie Siegel, senior fellow at CSIS and an expert in global economics. Stephanie, welcome.
Nice to be here.
We're talking today, May 17th, and President Biden is on his way to the G7. Before he left, he said, "The United States is not a deadbeat nation. We pay our debts." This reminded me of the Lannisters always paying their debts. What is the backdrop of this summit now that, you know, we have this debt crisis going on?
Right. So as you mentioned, President Biden was wheels up today, heading to Japan for the G7 Leaders Summit. He's leaving town at a time when negotiations on the debt ceiling are still ongoing, and where his Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, a few weeks ago said that the X date, meaning the date at which we are in danger of breaching the debt ceiling, is June 1st. So a few weeks away from that deadline. So what we learned yesterday, I believe, was that President Biden would be going to Japan, going to the Leaders Summit, but would be getting back on a plane to arrive back here on Sunday, as opposed to going on to Papua New Guinea and to Australia. So the domestic backdrop at a time when the president is going to demonstrate U.S. leadership, not just at the G7, but frankly to the rest of the world, is problematic, that he's having to disengage from that international outreach in order to come back and deal with domestic political matters. That's not a good look for the U.S. I think there's still a lot of hope that Japan can get a robust agenda, deliverables on that agenda out of the summit. I think that's probably the case, but it certainly would be better if Biden could stay overseas a bit longer.
So why is it problematic for the United States, though? I mean, when you're the top dog and you're having some negotiations at home, these other countries, you know, their economies pale in comparison to ours. So, like, why is it a bad look for us? We're just, isn't this just business as usual in the United States?
Well, I think saying that the other countries' economies pale in comparison to the U.S. is not necessarily the case if we're thinking beyond just the G7. The audience here, sure, you're working with the G7, but the audience here is truly a global audience. And the case that the U.S. and other G7 countries have made is that there is really a competition going on between democracies and authoritarian systems, that there's a competition going on between market economies and state-directed economies. And so that's really the backdrop. We're not just demonstrating the success of the U.S. economy. It's the success of the U.S. economy relative to what?
So we're not. So it's not that we're worried about what Japan thinks. It's we're worried about China.
Sure. And Japan is also worried about that as well. And Exhibit A for that is who they invited to observe the summit and to participate. It's not just G7 countries that are there. It's a number of other countries, including a handful that represent the kind of quote unquote global south. So you've got a number of large emerging market economies that are there. You've got India there, Indonesia, Vietnam. You also have Korea and Australia there as key partners of the US. And you have countries that are there representing the African Union and representing Pacific Islands. So it's really much more than just the G7. And the intent of that is to show engagement with the rest of the world and show leadership in order to engage with these countries and present a model that actually is a preferred model as opposed to the other one that's on offer.
So why can't this be portrayed as, you know, the United States is having a robust debate that has fallen along partisan lines, maybe predictably, versus China that is an authoritarian state that has its own problems with instability and is worried about what its people think?
Sure. And I actually think that would be a very wise way to portray the situation. Democracies can be messy, and there's a negotiation that's going on, and it's a negotiation that is going on, you know, somewhat publicly right now. And that negotiation is reflecting the will of the constituents that are engaged in that negotiation. So that is how I would present it. I think the pushback would be, this is creating some global economic uncertainty at a time when we don't need any additional uncertainty. There's a really serious agenda that Japan has teed up for this summit. There are a lot of critical issues that need to be discussed, including Ukraine, first and foremost, including the energy transition and climate change, including the need to mobilize trillions of dollars in the name of development and the energy transition. So there are a lot of really important issues that need to be the priority, as opposed to one that is definitely avoidable. So I think your point is well taken, but I think there's a better way to do this, and that's to not create crisis when there doesn't need to be one.
Right. So this is kind of the United States with an unforced error here and creating some measure of global instability, global economic instability.
The potential for such instability. And I believe we will avoid kind of the worst case outcome here. But I think there's no question that a lot of energy and attention has been diverted to deal with this, what is hopefully just a near crisis. And as we were talking about before, I think the upside scenario would be if we take this near crisis and actually get some kind of good deliverables out of it. And that could be good deliverables on the domestic front. We were talking earlier about what is part of this negotiation. Could there be some progress on things like permitting reform, which would be a good thing? And ideally, could there be some structural reform that comes out of this so that we are not in the position of having to negotiate a debt ceiling again?
So what are the things that can be accomplished at this summit?
So the priorities that were laid out by Japan, and I should back up here a little bit and just say this summit is the culmination of Japan's leadership for its G7 year. And leading up to the summit, you've had a number of ministerials that have been focused on key economic deliverables, key security deliverables, key energy security and climate change deliverables. So those ministerials have produced things that are now getting handed off to the leaders. So first and foremost, we've talked about Ukraine. Each one of the communiques coming out of these ministerials has started with Ukraine as a key issue that has the attention, the unified attention of the G7. So this idea that the leader summit will provide another opportunity to demonstrate continued engagement and commitment to Ukraine, I think is kind of first and foremost among the deliverables there. The other areas, and there's a pretty long list of things that Japan has prioritized. They include things on economic security. And so there's been a lot of buildup and kind of expectation that there'll be some discussion and maybe an announcement on tools to deal with economic coercion. And while I don't know that we're going to see kind of specific mention of China necessarily.
As the head coercer.
Well,
if that's a word.
Yeah, I think there's a subtext to a lot of the initiatives of the G7 that has kind of China there in the background, China and Russia there in the background. And for sure, when we're talking about Ukraine, there's no question. But when we're talking about economic coercion, for sure, we're talking about China.
And your colleagues, of course, just did a major report on that.
Yep. And one of my colleagues, Matt Reynolds, actually testified today, I think, on the report and on economic coercion. So there's a lot of interest here in the U.S., but also, I would say, shared by Japan and by the G7 to possibly put something in place to deal with economic coercion.
Can you explain what we actually mean when we're talking about Chinese economic coercion?
That's a good question, Andrew, because there's a lot of talk about economic statecraft and what that means. When we talk about economic coercion here, we talk about using economic tools in a way that is not transparent to get the outcome that you want. And so there's a lot of discussion, and I think you've heard some pushback. We heard it in the rollout event for the economic coercion report, basically saying, well, doesn't the U.S. use economic coercion? And there was a senior State Department official on that panel who said, I want to clarify, the U.S. does not use economic coercion. We have tools that are transparent and that are written into law. And so consistent with a rules-based system, we have certain tools that we will use, but you know what they are. There are export control regime, There are sanctions regime. And so you can actually see under the rule of law what our tools are, who is the target of that tool. What China does in comparison is much more opaque. So there's a sense that China might be retaliating for a certain action. It's never declared as such. And it actually has the impact of potentially influencing behavior before there's even an action. If you know that you're going to be in the sights of China and subject to some sort of retaliation, it will influence potentially your behavior. And it's that sort of coercion that I think the G7 and others are really looking to try to effectively combat.
So what are some of the activities that China actually engages in that are opaque?
Well, the report actually goes through, I think there are 8 or so case studies where they will put in place certain barriers to entry, whether you're talking about entry to China as a destination market for your exports, where for some reason, some sort of sanitary regulation, those imports are not allowed into the Chinese market. There could be protests, as was the case with a Korean store that operates in China, where there were protests outside of those stores in response to Korean action on a missile defense system that China didn't much like. There were different examples of retaliation when a Chinese dissident was honored with the Nobel Peace Prize. So there are a number of examples where countries' products are basically not allowed into the Chinese market, or where the foreign act or a foreign company is somehow the victim of retaliation. Never because of a stated policy that we are responding to X, it just happens to follow on, you know, in response to an action taken by that country.
So interesting and something to really watch. We're certainly going to be watching it here at CSIS. Let's move on to what's the role of the G7 in technology sectors like AI and semiconductors?
Yeah, I'm glad that you asked that question because I should have kind of mentioned that as far as what Japan has identified as a priority for its G7 year. So there are kind of 2 top headline issues when we're talking about technology that have been raised in the context of this year's G7. One is in response to the Russian invasion and a series of technology export controls that have been levied against Russia. And part of that is to degrade their military capability over the long term. And other controls that have been put in place this more in a China context as relates to semiconductors. And there are restrictions that were put in place back in October 7th of last year, that prevent the Chinese from having a capability to produce the most advanced semiconductors. I'm bringing up those 2 specific examples because in the first case, there was unified action taken by not just the G7, but a number of allies and partners that had kind of multilateralized the restrictions on tech exports. In the case of the semiconductors and semiconductor equipment, it was unilateral action that was taken by the United States in October that have been now agreed by Japan and a non-G7 but EU member country, the Netherlands. So the G7 has a role in working to multilateralize some of the restrictions that the US can put in place. That's one key area on the technology front. The other is one that has been in the news an awful lot over the past week or two, and that relates to generative AI, these things like ChatGPT. There was a big hearing just yesterday on the importance of understanding this technology and the potential to regulate this technology. That hearing was here in the US Congress. But one of the key witnesses at that hearing has also been speaking to global leaders, including the Prime Minister of Japan. And the Prime Minister has actually made advancing the possibility of some sort of coordinated regulation on AI as a potential deliverable in the G7.
This is Sam Altman you're talking
about.
Correct. Yep. And so you know, it's funny because I read a couple news reports about the hearing yesterday, and one was even a report that was generated by ChatGPT, but ChatGPT got it wrong. It misquoted Sam Altman.
It hallucinated.
Yes. So it's not always, we're not there yet, right?
No, we're not there. I mean, and this is exactly the point. I think people recognize the power of this technology, that power leading to potential, amazing potential, also risks, unforeseen risks, and where that leads. And so getting that balance right between leveraging the potential of this technology, but in a way that isn't fundamentally destabilizing to our society, that's a pretty tall order, but it's a really important issue. And it's one that we're grappling with here in the U.S. And I think the Prime Minister was wise to put it on the agenda for the G7. What comes out of that, I think, as you pointed out, it is early days in the sense of you don't want to regulate something that actually stifles the innovation to the point of stifling the innovation. But you also want to be kind of going into this eyes wide open and trying to identify what are the potential risks. And if you can do that in a way where it's not the U.S. acting alone or Japan acting alone, but in a way where the largest democracies are agreeing on a certain set of standards for AI, a certain set of codes when it comes to transparency in, you know, the algorithms and the data sets that are being used to train those algorithms, that's probably the model that we should be aspiring to.
That's a big issue. Another big issue, as you pointed out, is the climate crisis.
Yes.
And what role is the G7 actually going to have when they're dealing with the future of global climate policy?
So this, Andrew, as you know, is a huge issue. It's one where there's a tremendous amount of work going on here at CSIS, as well as pretty much in every capital and every country and every city globally. I think, one, there is a recognition that it is a crisis, that we are basically globally not on track to meeting our targets that are consistent with the Paris Agreement, and that we are also at a potential tipping point when it comes to global warming and not being able to meet the objective of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So I would say first and foremost, there's going to be recognition at the leaders' level of the urgency of the situation and the need to act. What is that action? And here's where it starts to become difficult. What we're talking about here is actually making an energy transition. And an energy transition where we are not dependent on fossil fuels for our primary source of energy, and in particular, the emissions that come from burning those fossil fuels. And here, the G7 is kind of an interesting grouping of countries because you have, as I mentioned, all these advanced economies that by and large have peaked their emissions. So the advanced economies are basically the reason that all that carbon is up in the air to begin with, but we are currently not the largest emitter, nor are we forecast to be the largest source of emissions going forward. It's the emerging markets there that as their economies grow, the energy intensity is growing, and they are going to be the largest emitters. And at least in one case, China, they already are the largest global emitter. So per capita basis, the U.S. is still ahead of China on that score. But for overall emissions, China is actually a bigger emitter than the U.S. And it's not just China, but it's also India growing its emissions, Brazil, a number of emerging market economies. And here, what the G7 can do, I think, beyond just kind of acknowledging the crisis piece, what we can do, I think that's where we get into the engagement with the global south. And I think one of the reasons that Japan has invited the countries that it has, it's not the only reason for sure, but one of the reasons is that it's really key to engage emerging market economies and to bridge from the G7 to the G20. So one of the countries that I mentioned that's there is India. India is the current president of the G20 group of countries. And then next year, it goes from India to Brazil. Brazil will also be there in Japan. And so I think the G7 demonstrating a certain sense of obligation and commitment on this issue and bringing in these critical economies is a key kind of outcome of this year's summit.
Stephanie, finally, we've talked about Ukraine. We've talked around Ukraine. What do you think can be accomplished at this G7 summit vis-a-vis Ukraine?
Well, I think, you know, we were talking earlier about the need to reaffirm the commitment to Ukraine. I don't think there's any doubt that the G7 statement is going to come out and firmly announce a continued ongoing commitment to Ukraine. I think there's also the need to kind of demonstrate that commitment, and that comes through the provision of financing, which has been part of the finance communique and will continue to be prioritized there in the leader's statement. And there's the near-term financing needs. There's also a longer-term commitment there to Ukraine's reconstruction. And so I expect that we're going to see language as well, that commitment to the long and medium term of Ukraine. And then the other piece here, we talked a little bit earlier about China kind of looming in the background. I do think that there is, beyond the commitment to Ukraine and you know, making sure that Russia knows that there's that longstanding commitment, it is also a message of deterrence to others. And the Prime Minister of Japan has kind of made the point of using this summit to underscore the commitment to rule of law and a rules-based international system. I think the audience there is more than just Russia. So I think that's going to be kind of another key takeaway from the summit.
Well, Stephanie, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog